evening. This is Jim Breeling. Welcome to the third Sunday call-in in our fall series. Want to call attention to something on two things on the NEA-BPD webpage. One is the free online course for professionals, but it's actually open to anyone. And I have to say I undertook to go through it feeling I should is just a fulfilling the duty. And I think it is the best thing that I've seen for clear, well-organized, lucid, informative online in-service instruction. And I've benefited from it meaningfully, and I encourage you all to do it. We also have a review commentary from one of our listeners last Sunday, which, oh dear, who read, "I am spreading the word to 12 colleagues and friends, mentors, peers from 7 different states about the NEA-BPD's new online course for professionals. The course is well-designed, clear, succinct distillation of the most current information about BBD. Where else can you learn about cutting-edge research, and effective evidence-based clinical treatment in just 2 hours? With 6 20-minute units available online anytime, the opportunity to earn CEUs, RCECs at no cost aside from a voluntary donation, and a high-interest, engaging learning experience, this course will appeal to a wide and diverse audience. Professionals will come away from the course better informed and perhaps even inspired and motivated to be a part of a solution to one of the most pressing public health conditions of our time." So I, you know, anyone going to see a provider that is not too well acquainted with borderline, certainly call this to the attention. I would even call it to the attention to someone who's well-informed, who may be a useful resource for you, and that is on the line. Now, a great deal of what the NEA-BPD does is a result of volunteer efforts, and that's true this evening, that everyone you'll hear in behind the scenes and so forth has volunteered their time very nicely. But the world is not completely that way for things like the webpage and audio recordings of these call-ins and videos. And very nicely, we had a very nice response last week on the call-ins for donations. And I would encourage you again to look, if you were going to a meeting with the travel, the meals, the lodging, the registration fee, and this was maybe one out of 10 or 12 sessions that you went to, you'd probably have $500 or $600 or more easily invested, and you're getting this at the convenience at home. So I encourage you on the right-hand side near the online course, donate to the NEA-BPD. It's a 501c3 organization, which means it's tax-deductible to the extent allowed by law, and you can use a credit card or PayPal. It's all set up. There's also there to call your attention next week, there's a blog there for responding to issues or matters that come up in the connecting the dots. So for that, I encourage you when you're doing the connecting the dots call-in session, as we will have again in a couple weeks, why to look at that for the way to respond. And our speaker tonight is just tremendous. He's what we need, five, six dozen, really. Young, bright, well-trained, very capable psychiatrist, worked with John Gunderson, is now at the Mayo Clinic, and as you know, can see from the online courses, been involved with that. This is Brian Palmer. And I want to get out of the way. I guess the last thing, if you have questions, anything that's not clear and you're wondering about it as Dr. Palmer goes through, send your question to the NEABPD@AOL.com, and we'll get your request to clarification to Dr. Palmer so that the presentation is completely clear to you. Also, at the end, we hope we'll have some time for questions and answers. So So along the way, if you have questions, do send those in too. And Dr. Palmer has very graciously agreed that the questions we don't have time to get to during the session tonight, he will look at and respond in writing, and we can post that on the webpage. Last week, there were a number of such questions for Dr. Maffei, and she has responded to those. And as soon as I do a little editing and formatting of it, why, they will be on the website as well. So with that, let me get out of the way for this super presentation by Dr. Palmer.
Thanks, Jim. Good to speak with you, and hello to everyone listening. I'll spend the next 45 minutes or so talking about what we're now calling good psychiatric management. The origin here is that it was initially referred to as general psychiatric management, and I'll show you in a minute in a head-to-head study with DBT, performed equally well and is now one of the six evidence-based treatments for borderline. What it has, I think, that I will emphasize are two important aspects. One is a focus on the interpersonal nature of borderline. And rather than seeing it exclusively in terms of emotional reactivity, this treatment takes as its core interest in the interpersonal experience of someone with borderline. And that builds both on the epidemiology and the genetics and what we understand about the disorder, and certainly it builds on Dr. John Gunderson's life work to clarify the disorder. And for this presentation, really credit goes to Dr. Gunderson, who has developed GPM, as we call it. I help with trainings, and we just finished an 8-hour training in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and a 4-hour training in Rochester, Minnesota. They just did a 4-hour version in Amsterdam, and this is now taking on a life of its own with trainings around the country and around the world as more and more people are requesting exposure to this type of treatment. So I've tried to condense what is ultimately an 8-hour day with cases and workshops and breakout sessions and heavy content into a 45-minute overview of the key features so that people on the call can have a nice understanding of that. So I'll try to do my best to refer to the slides by number as we go through so that everyone can follow. But beginning is section one, we'll talk about some of the background and overall principles of GPM. Beginning with the idea, slide three, that borderline patients should be able to assume that professionals who treat them have been trained to do so. And we know that that's, no one on this call is surprised to hear that certainly that's a reasonable expectation, and that training is systematically of variable quality and variable availability, both in psychiatric residencies and psychology and social work training programs around the country. And so this is certainly our overall assumption. By way of overview, slide four, treatment of borderline is not done consistently or well around the country. Most clinicians, it's true in the outcome studies, most clinicians don't like treating patients with BPD, and there is a shortage of well-trained BPD treaters. The idea now, though, is that if we can teach people the basic principles of treating patients with borderline, we can help clinicians both derive much more personal satisfaction from this work, and I probably am a case study in that. I don't think I ever intended to specialize in the treatment of borderline personality disorder. I had gone through psychiatry residency, had done well. I was a chief resident at Harvard and was going to pursue treatment of psychosis and had an epidemiological background in suicide and schizophrenia. And I found in working with borderline patients, it was an opportunity available to me, but it has made me a better clinician with all of my patients, recognizing my own reactions, being able to manage intense emotions of my own, of other people, and I've really derived considerable personal satisfaction from this work, and I think that's really the upside of this for clinicians. It makes us all better in a way that's really the best for clinicians. So on to the initial data. This came in 2009 in the American Journal of Psychiatry, the big psychiatry journal. And a group in Canada compared these principles of general psychiatric management, which essentially was Dr. Gunderson's textbook on clinical management of borderline personality disorder, compared that well done by people with experience and interest in treating borderline with high-quality DBT. And Dr. Linehan herself has supported the fact that this was DBT by the book, very well done, and called Dr. Gunderson when this came out to let him know. She thought that they were onto something, that this was, in fact, as good as DBT. And it did so. It did well in the outcome studies. Now, the follow-up study has been published 2 years later. Again, the outcomes are equally good, which is very encouraging. I think most people on the call are familiar that DBT has a robust evidence base, and I certainly don't want to imply that general psychiatric management or good psychiatric management has as well studied an evidence base, but it certainly does draw on the medical evidence well. So slide 6, the outcome equals DBT, dialectical behavioral therapy. In terms of the decrease in deliberate self-harm, the decrease in hospitalizations, the decrease in depression symptoms, and as I mentioned, these were this treatment was done by therapists with 5 or more years of experience that were guided by the textbook, and they did meet weekly for group supervision. So this was a well-run study. The basic structure of the study and of what I'm going to go over tonight for general psychiatric management, GPM, good psychiatric management, is we'll meet once weekly if that's useful. And if it feels helpful, then we may meet more than that. If it is not helpful or your life is not improving, we will meet less than that. So from the very beginning, the relationship itself becomes contingent on change in the patient's life. I'll go through soon why. It is a psychodynamic treatment in the sense that it looks at unrecognized motives and feelings and defenses related to interpersonal hypersensitivity, but it's also a behavioral treatment. There's accountability for patients, contingencies about their work and improvement. It's practical. It often includes medication management. It is designed to fit into what happens in day-to-day mental health care in this country and, frankly, in other parts of the world as well, unlike some of the manualized treatments that are specific protocolized treatment. This is intentionally designed to fit with the day-to-day practice of psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers in community practice. It emphasizes work as a stabilizing force. I'll go through a little bit of the data of why, but basically the two big outcome studies both show that patients with borderline improve considerably over time. However, what is clearly lacking is vocational rehabilitation. At the end of the 10 years on the Collaborative Longitudinal Personality Disorder Study, only about a third had full-time work, even though most people could achieve symptomatic remission by the end of that study. So there is an eye in GPM to the stabilizing force of work and structure in people's life. And while love may feel appealing, and it is important, work is the emphasis. Split treatments in GPM are desirable, meaning that there could be more than one provider for the patient working together, and family interventions are done as needed. I'll get to that at the end. So that's the brief overview, and I'm going to go through some of the highlights. Again, this is an 8-hour course condensed down into 45 minutes, so it will undoubtedly just pique interest, and if you have a strong interest, you could certainly enroll in the 8-hour course. We'll be doing it again next fall. That will be sponsored by Mayo, and there are other opportunities coming up. We'll have another 8-hour course at the American Psychiatric Association meeting in San Francisco this spring as well. So lots of opportunity to do this. So slide 8 introduces us to section 2, and I'm going to spend a few minutes getting into the interpersonal nature of borderline. For many listeners on this call, this will be new and a little bit different. Much of the borderline treatment approach is dominated by DBT, which is a behavioral approach focused on skills to manage emotions, tolerate distress, and behavior change over time. I'm trained in DBT. I have worked in an intensive DBT program. I like DBT, and DBT is a very good treatment. Mentalization-based treatment is another treatment I was trained in and worked with Anthony Bateman briefly for supervision, and we had a mentalization approach at McLean that was pretty robust, and I like mentalization. But this treatment, I think, blends some of the best of both of those, but also adds an eye to the interpersonal. And we're going to talk some, and I may spend more time on these slides and speed through some of the others, because I think this is what GPM really adds to the field. So slide 9, interpersonal hypersensitivity is the core feature of GPM, and that borderline has a unifying latent genetic core, so that about 55% of the heritability is explained by this genetic core in BPD, and I'll go through a little bit about what is genetic. But what was surprising now, this is new research in the last 2 years, is it was assumed that if you looked at the genetics, people would either inherit a high degree of affective response or behavioral impulsivity or interpersonal problems. But it turns out that all of those features of borderline are well unified genetically, and that the unifying latent genetic core, we believe, has to do with these interpersonal features of the disorder. The interpersonal features are the most discriminating in terms of determining who will have borderline and what the course and outcome will be. Interpersonal events are what predict remissions and relapses, self-injury, dissociation, suicide. There's elevated cortisol and HPA reactivity and neurohormone deficits. I won't get into the details of that. And there is certainly data that from childhood early attachment problems, separation problems, and hypersensitivity, these are predictive of adult BPD. So the eye here is on the interpersonal. And the coherence to the interpersonal theory is summarized on slide 10 and 11. And if there's nothing else you get out of tonight, slide 10 and 11 is what I want to make sure that I've covered in enough detail that you understand it. So slide 10, this fits in my clinical experience quite well, that when people with borderline feel held, feel supported, understood, cared for, they can come across as depressed, or depressive, waif-like, rejection-sensitive, idealizing of the person who's caring for them, collaborative, and that state is the state that people often want to get to because it feels better to feel that way. And it protects against, although this is always going to come, because it's impossible that anyone can ever always feel held, supported, understood. So inevitably, the person at some point feels threatened, and the system gets activated. In that state, there's a high degree of blame of the self or the other. Patients come across as angry, self-punitive, manipulative, devaluative. All of these features get active. And when I train residents, they'll see a patient in the ED, and they'll say to me something like, well, she didn't feel borderline. By which I think they mean she wasn't angry. And that is true in some ways, that when threatened, borderline patients can be angry. But these, as everybody on the call knows who works with and loves these people, borderline patients are not running around angry all the time. It's angry in response to a sense that that feeling of being held is going to leave. And the fear in this threatened sense is protecting against the third state, which is this sense of aloneness, which is the fear to begin with. And this intolerance of aloneness is what holds sway in borderline. So when alone, patients can become dissociative, paranoid, desperately impulsive. And on slide 11, this is saying the same thing but unifying it. So when people feel connected, there's this idealizing, dependent, rejection-sensitive stance, that when met with an interpersonal stress, meaning someone's angry at the patient, there's a perceived separation, a criticism, the person can feel threatened. And in that threatened state becomes devaluative, self-injurious, angry, anxious, help-seeking. There's an activation of the system. Now, that will result in one of two things. The first, on the right-hand side of the slide, is that the other person will pull away. That's an understandable and natural response if someone's acting in a devaluative, self-injurious, angry way, that the other person, the boyfriend, may leave. Or the other person may increase their support, increase their involvement, provide a sense of rescue, which returns the person on the left-hand side of the slide back to this connected state. If there is withdrawal, then the really terrifying experience of aloneness develops, which can progress into a state of suicidal despair, where there is a sense that the person is unlovable and unloved, and that in that state is where borderline patients are at risk of completing suicide. But even there, there can be interruption by a holding environment, such as a hospital, a jail, another rescuer. Somebody comes into the system and returns the person to the top part. Now, borderline patients frequently live in this range of experiences, but frequently aren't aware of it. So when I take care of patients primarily in the hospital now, when they come into the hospital, be on the unit for 10 minutes playing cards with the other patients in the milieu and feel better, they have no interest in talking about what happened that brought them in because they're feeling better, which is understandable. But with GPM, there's a high degree of interest in what happened here. What was the interpersonal context that precipitated this stress, and helping the patient learn what's happening in their interpersonal life is taken as a high priority area in GPM. So on to slide 12, GPM predicts the sensitivity and reactivity, the interpersonal hypersensitivity predicts the sensitivity and reactivity to being held. It explains the phenomena of BPD. The dynamics are that patients who feel an unacceptable anger or passivity will view themselves as bad, that when they feel attached, it can either be a dependency exploitation attachment or an inseparability agreement attachment, either of which have problems, and that the emotional and behavioral symptoms are secondary to interpersonal stress. They don't just occur in a vacuum. They don't just occur because that was a bad day. They occur in the context of an interpersonal stressor. So, on to the next slide, 13, the treatment approach is to take an interest in this interpersonal experience, slow down cliches, assumptions, attributions, shortcut, and stay curious about the context and the interpretation of the context, the thoughts about it, that preceded the feelings and behaviors. So this explains why all of the evidence-based treatments of borderline need to have an active therapist. These patients do not do well with therapists that are neutral or not interested. It requires a high degree of activeness in the therapy. It lends itself to practical here and now issues. It explains the ambivalence of suicide attempts. It explains the role of hospitals, structure, and reliability, moving patients from a disorganized state to a higher degree of internal containment. And it lends itself to this not knowing mentalization-based treatment stance that providers who do well with borderline patients take as their stance. Being curious about what happened is a very important thing, and helping the patient be curious about, well, what am I experiencing right now? What was happening before I started feeling this way? On to the next slide, 15. The reason, then, that traditional psychoanalytic techniques, and just a sidebar here, that the term borderline itself came because people who would go to see a psychoanalyst who would sit behind them for 4 hours a week and listen to what came to mind, borderline patients would be driven crazy by this. I might not like it so well myself, but it is useful for the for what it does, but not helpful for borderline patients. And so they were seen as on the border between neurotic and psychotic because under the stress of an analysis could easily become psychotic. And this neutrality that the therapeutic stance would require in psychoanalysis encourages the patient to have projections and have a sense of abandonment, and then psychoanalysts would interpret the negative motivations, which are then experienced by the patient, as very invalidating and blaming, and the passivity of the therapist encourages the patient to feel like the therapist is not interested. And that process, while it's a useful process for some people, borderline patients get worse with psychoanalysis, and it is not something that is indicated for borderline. So, again, I just bring that up as data to support the argument here of why a treatment has to think about the interpersonal nature of this disorder, and that the relationship between the therapist and the client or patient needs to have an eye on what's happening in that relationship and what's happening in the interpersonal life outside of the relationship. Or as the cartoon says, slide 16, I don't feel like we're making much progress with my abandonment issues, doctor, as the analyst has gotten up from the chair and left the room. So, slide 17, overall principles. The therapeutic stance is that the relationship between the therapist and the provider is a dyadic one. It's a real relationship. We do advocate selective self-disclosure, being real in the room. There is a way in which the relationship serves as a container, and the stance is to be active but not reactive. So taking a sustained interest in the patient but not reacting to the problem of the day as much as getting interested in what the experience of that problem is. It requires a stance that is cautious, uncertain, thoughtful, trying to be curious and interested in, well, what was that like? Now, when she said that, what did you feel? What happened then? What did you do next? Now, say more about that. How did you decide to do that? Getting interested in what the patient's experience is. I had a patient who came onto our inpatient unit, and she, borderline patient, who had been struggling, and she announced to me, I'm manic. She was not manic. She had slept 8 hours the night before, and she looked fine, but she was certain that she was manic. And that explained everything. She didn't need to think about what had happened, the problem she had had with her girlfriend, the struggle she was having with school, with a deadline, the conflict. She just said, I'm manic, and I just need to come into the hospital. And that shortcut is a terrible disservice to her. And my strategy with her was to stay very interested in, when were you last doing well? What came next? When did it start to unravel? What was happening then? Now, what happened with a girlfriend then? What was going on at school? Now, where's work in this? What were you doing? And getting interested in what her experience was of feeling afraid, feeling angry, feeling unsure, not knowing what was going to happen, helping her talk about how she grew so destabilized is where the action is. This is pragmatic. Every patient is different. Forgo the theory if it's not working. If it's not working right now, wait, and it may work later. And the stance is to be realistically encouraging. Most patients with borderline do get better, and most patients with borderline continue to have some problems. And I think holding both of those together is important. Slide 19. I include the general myths, since it's a busy slide, but it is a myth that patients resist treatment. Most patients are actively seeking relief from their pain. Treatment for personality disorder requires psychoeducation by the clinician. BPD patients angrily attack their treaters. BPD patients rarely get better. That's certainly not true. In the two biggest studies, we find that 80% no longer meet the diagnostic criteria within 10 years, and once people achieve relapse, remission is actually quite rare. The next one is a myth, too, that borderline patients only get better if given extended intensive treatment by experts. It is true that some patients need that. I worked in a program that specialized in that subset. But most patients actually do well by intermittent treatment with well-meaning non-experts, and these highly intensive treatments can easily become regressive if the treater isn't sensitive to it. So, in general, community care can be quite good if the therapist is able to understand some basic principles like the ones we're going over tonight. recurrent risk of suicide invariably burdens treaters and carries as liability risk. That's actually not accurate. On the ones that are it's accurate for are often poorly structured treatment. And recurrent crises require treaters to be available 24/7. That's actually not not true. And if it is true, it means that another level of care is needed and the patient isn't appropriate for outpatient care. So slide 20, supportive interventions, acknowledging the distress that the patient is, validating the subjective experience, using discerning self-disclosures, and providing appropriate reassurance. There are cautions, trauma, countertransference, compliments, there are cautions in parentheses about each of these. But in general, supporting the patient's experience is useful. And this is a pragmatic treatment. We don't know entirely what it is in all of these evidence-based treatments that helps the patients get better. So these non-specific factors, showing up, being reliable, listening, expressing concern, those things matter for patients, and those are good principles that are non-specific but central. The relational issue that develops with the therapist is also central. Forming a sense of attachment, trust, a positive dependency, and by which I mean I supervise residents now, and I've seen cases where patients can easily become dependent on their therapist in a way that's not a positive dependency, it's just a regression and somebody else is solving their problems for them. A positive dependency is when the patient is able to come in and say, well, I tried this, here's what I thought about this. This didn't go so well this week. And the therapist is saying, well, tell me, sorry, it didn't go so well. What are you thinking about that? What can we talk about that would be helpful? There's a collaboration involved, and that the patient knows that the therapist will be in their corner and will help them think about what they may learn from the experience they had that week. Situational changes can be essential. We're fond of saying that on an inpatient unit, one of the most important things that can happen is taking a second to make some changes in the outside life sometimes. It is true that a bad job and a bad relationship can really wreak havoc on all of our lives, and learning how to push pause on that and change the situation can be helpful. In fact, in our offices, as GPM providers, sometimes we'll pick up the phone or help the patient pick up the phone and make some calls and actually address some of the situation. Again, this is practical, pragmatic stuff. Whatever's going to help somebody's life go better is probably useful to them. Try not to make interpretations unless they're done via questions or normalizing. So rather than assuming I know what the patient thinks, we try to help the patient figure out what it is they think and feel, and rather than observing, you know, I think you may be angry at me today. You walked in late, you sat down, your arms are crossed, and we did have that tough conversation last week. I wonder what's going on. Mistaken interventions are inevitable, useful, and reversible. If I screw something up, I apologize to the patient, and it's actually quite helpful to model that. It's one of the wonderful things about DBT is that everybody's doing the best they can and can do better, and I fully believe that. I believe it for families that I work with and professionals that I work with. Okay, that was clearly a lousy session we had last week. Where did we go wrong? What was my role in it? And okay, I can acknowledge if that's the case, and I can challenge if it's not the case. Education is essential, even when it's seemingly ignored. We do advocate teaching people about what they got. Slide 22, the treatment approach. I've mentioned most of this already, being inquisitive. Slide 23 talks about the phases of therapy. So the beginning part is what we, in the handbook, there's a full handbook for GPM that is not yet published and is in the process of being revised, re-revised, and eventually published with a series of accompanying videos that we've made that go through lots of cases and opportunities to practice this stuff. But the phases of therapy, we talk about a contractual alliance in the handbook, the beginning part of forming an alliance together. It's not necessarily that there's a contract, but it's the process of coming to how are we going to work together. And that moves into a relational alliance where the patient and the therapist can come to like each other and trust that the therapist is there to help and is trying to do right by the patient. And eventually this, what I called earlier positive dependency, is made more explicit, things are more comfortable, there's a way in which people can talk more real about what's going on in life. And then eventually generalizing the learning and becoming non-borderline, leading to recovery. So that the sequence of expectable changes is first to focus on subjective distress, second to focus on behavioral change, third to focus on interpersonal change, and finally to focus on social function. And that slide contains the timeline and approach. So 25, the process of change is to learn to think first. What's happening right now? What's going on with me that I'm so distressed? What happened before this? How did it get started, right? Helping the patient find a way to think in the face of all of this distress is where the action is. I'm not going to go through any neurobiology tonight, I promise. But what we know is that the amygdala and the limbic structures are hyperactive and that the goal of treatment is to get the person thinking in the face of their distress. That's what all of these evidence-based treatments have in common. Mentalization-based treatment, DBT, all of these get the patient actively aware of what's going on with them in the moment. Second, get a life, in quotes, that social rehabilitation matters. It is as useful as anything else I do to help the patient focus on volunteering, getting into a job that may provide them structure, and supporting them as they do. One of the cautions I always give families is it's so tempting when your loved one does get that first job after they've been in treatment for a bit or they try volunteering, and it's easy when you've been through so much with them to sort of want to breathe a sigh of relief, oh, they made it. That's a time to increase the support. That's a time when somebody's trying something new and it's hard for them. And that's a time to be more supportive, not less supportive. It's the most common mistake I've seen parents make in dealing with borderline kids who are trying to change is that moment. So there's your pearl family-wise for the evening. And finally, the corrective experience. The therapist is a caretaker and a role model. It's a real relationship of real caring that's trying to help somebody manage themselves differently. So section four, making the diagnosis. I'm going to go through this one fairly briefly, and this is covered in lots of areas, and I've covered all of this on previous talks to this audience. So I cringe at the idea I'm borderline. People assume they're malicious and manipulative. I don't want that to be me. And there can be, especially if patients have worked in the healthcare system, especially the mental health care system before, there can certainly be negative reactions to this. But the sources of stigma are complex and even have to do with the patient's own self-concept, the last bullet there, as thinking themselves as bad or evil that can affect that. Number 29. The benefits of disclosing the diagnosis, patients feel less alone with it. And slide 30 summarizes this well. This was a small, unpublished study from McLean Hospital, just looking at if you tell people a diagnosis, how do they feel? And it turns out they don't feel any more or less shame. They don't feel any more or less likable. But that third line, they do feel more hopeful, and that's important. And overall have a better sense of their own future. So the just making the diagnosis of BPD can be very helpful for people. The criteria I've grouped here into four areas. We're not going to go through all the criteria. The next slide, 32, the course and outcome. There are two lines here. These are from the two big studies that followed borderline patients out over time. The green line plots the percent remitted, how many no longer meet the diagnostic criteria, and that's from the McLean Study of Adult Development. And the red line plots the number of criteria out of nine that each person on average meets over the course of the study. So that at the beginning, people met 6.5 out of the 9 criteria on average. By the end of year one, it was 4.1, 3.8, and on down. So both of these studies show the same thing, that patients do get better. And the good thing is that the percent that have this is the cumulative percent that relapse of the ones who have met remission, only 12% are defining relapse as going back to meeting criteria for a year. They have very few relapses overall, far better than anything we see with depression, bipolar, schizophrenia, anything else we treat in psychiatry. However, the mean GAF scores, the global assessment of functioning scores, borderline patients in these studies don't function as well as the red dot other personality disorders or the green dot major depressive disorder. So that people get better but are still not functioning well. About only a third have full-time jobs or marriages by the end of their treatment. This is a little bit about what I mentioned earlier on the genetics, that we quote somewhere between 55 and 69% for the component of borderline that's genetic. And the second study is the one I mentioned earlier, second set of studies combination is the fact I mentioned earlier in the introduction, the twin studies and one family study, that a single latent factor accounts for the co-occurrence of these four components of borderline, which is important news, and I think speaks to why GPM makes good theoretical sense. 36, for families, we want people to realize that mental illness is a problem that is not necessarily a symptom of a dysfunctional family. It's a person in need of help. Sure, families can learn and do better, and many on the call are in the process of learning and doing better. And at the end of the day, it's not about pathologizing the family. Family support is needed for treatment of mental illness. Psychoeducation requires being informed about therapy, prognosis, and course. Families who do better are the ones who are on the call tonight, learning as much as they can, trying to get better at this stuff. Psychoeducation can diminish the harmful anger and criticism that can be toxic in families. And families often don't recognize the cost of the illness. There's alienation, social isolation, for the parents as well as the offspring. It's hard when your friends are asking, well, why don't you just try this or try that? So bad parents are not uninformed or ill. Bad parents are uninformed or ill, not malevolent. And we take as principle that most parents do not try to harm their children. They're not setting out to. In fact, most, that's just rarely the case. And the ones that are actually trying to harm their children are not the ones who make it to treatment with us. And the last one is that families are burdened and new management strategies can relieve that. So, and I'm realizing I've included more slides than necessary, but I want to go through a few more points, and I'll just try to hit the high points on this by way of overview. Slide 37 introduces us to how to get started with this treatment. In building an alliance, the first thing is to address the subjective distress and activities of daily living. How you doing? How can we help? Provide some psychoeducation, make the diagnosis in a way that can engender hope. Enlist the patient's involvement. We recommend homework. We recommend using email occasionally, especially for appointment stuff, but even occasionally to something to talk about in the next session. I don't respond to patients over email during the week, but if I have a patient thinking about herself and writing it down, that's a good thing. I might, in terms of homework, ask the patient early on to write their own autobiography. How do you understand yourself? And it's a fascinating assignment. People will come back with, some will obsessionally come back with 15 pages, some will come back with a paragraph, but it's a wonderful place to begin because what we're trying to do is help patients build a narrative of their own life that makes sense so that they can get to the point of understanding themselves in these particularly moments of distress, but across their relationships, across the patterns in their lives, who they are as a constant person across all of these things is the goal. Situational stressors are worth addressing. What's going on? Having a call to somebody, having an occasional conjoint meeting. Can we meet together with the family therapist? Can we meet together with the skills group leader? How are you addressing that in a very practical way? And availability between sessions, yes, available, but your safety can't depend on my availability, and we need a plan to manage it. Goals together, making goals together is an alliance building process, and it's not essential that there be a goal per se. So DBT, for example, takes suicidality, certainly suicidality is important, and self-harm as the top priority no matter what. GPM doesn't take a strong stance on that. This is practical. So it's it's the goal is to get to the point of saying my goal is to not cut myself and how to work on that, rather than making that a requirement for the beginning of a therapy. It's guided by feasibility. What can we do? What's the patient invested in? What are we going to work on? How can we work on it together? And the last bullet emphasizes getting a life. The work is more important than love. Or cartoon, the end is near. Yes, but what are your goals? I'm not going to go through the algorithm for intercession availability, but again, in a practical, pragmatic way, call me if you need to. And usually that works fine. Sometimes the patient won't call and should have, and then you take it up. Why not? Sometimes they'll call for repeatedly for non-crisis calls, and that's the issue most clinicians are most concerned about. So take it up. If it was helpful, how? Did you wonder about how I felt when you called or what it was like for me to be on the receiving end of that call at 2:30 in the morning? Okay. How else can we do it? And so there's a way in which this all becomes grist for the mill. It's about finding a way in the relationship to talk about these issues rather than just act them out. And that's a challenge for therapists to bring this up, to the next session, follow up on that. You know, the patient's feeling better, they don't want to talk about it, they're embarrassed. Bringing it up and getting interested in that is where the action is. 42, common problems, I'm not going to get into. There's a 43 and 44, managing self-harm and safety, seven basic principles. I'll let you read those on your own, and I'm not in the course of tonight going to get into the principles for managing safety, but we articulate them and try to help the providers learn the principles for managing safety and managing safety during crisis. 45, I think, expresses some of the same principles again. The first is to express concern when patients alert you to safety issues. Not doing that will certainly result in them amping up the safety issues. Allow them to ventilate. Avoid taking unilateral actions and ask the patient to be explicit about wanting help. They are responsible for the management of their own safety in collaboration with me. And that is a principle that's very important to this treatment. It's easy, when I work with residents, they get anxious and they want to put the patient in the hospital or fix it. But asking the patient, what are you doing? What have you done so far? What's working? What's your plan to manage it? And work on identifying what the stressor was. And then number 46, after the crisis, follow up. What was that like? What happened? How do we understand that in the context of the appointments? Actively interpret how they felt better. What was it about going into the hospital that helped you feel better, or coming in the emergency room, or calling me, or calling your mother, or calling some? What was that helped you feel better? Back to that interpersonal model. Identify the unfeasibility of depending on my availability. Problem solve about available alternatives, and again, identify the stressor. What was it that caused that? The next section I'm going to skip over, it's a summary of some psychopharmacological strategies, again, that are very practical. We have an algorithm that makes use of both the data for the meds, which, by the way, as most of you on the call know, the data is fairly thin. Meds help, and we use them, but that they are not the end-all, be-all, and they all have safety concerns, including weight gain, including other factors, but that the most important part of psychopharmacology is staying in this therapeutic stance that helps the patient learn, are the meds helping? So rather than assuming that there's some pill that's going to change the neurochemistry and fix the problem, back to the I'm manic approach, getting the patient to think, what is it that's changing if I'm on the medicine or not on the medicine? How do I know what's different? What do I expect to be different? How will I know if it's different? How do we work on this together? And then in general, having one change at a time is the principle. And I'm skipping down to slide 54, multimodal treatment, section 8. And this is about how people get along together in split treatment. So you might have a group. If we had to recommend one additional treatment beyond individual treatment with a psychiatrist or psychologist, it would be a group. And so if there's a group involved in the care, it could be a DBT skills group, a mentalization group, an interpersonal group, a self-help group. Anything would be helpful. Establishing clear roles between the multiple people on the team. Who's in charge? Who's managing crises? Who's going to take phone calls from family members? Insist that the team members have a right to talk to each other, and that's a condition of treatment, with the understanding that the individual therapist is not going to disclose personal or sensitive issues to the other members of the team, childhood sexual abuse. There's no need to share the details of that outside the individual therapy, but that the how the patient's doing after disclosing that is certainly important to share with the rest of the team. Examine conflicts on the team. Don't protect or agree with. So if somebody's mad with the group leader, okay, what did they do? And they may have, take it up. And how are you going to talk to the group leader about that? Urge that that complaint be voiced to the other member of the team. 56, I've already mentioned that groups are generally very helpful, and there are several different types of groups, slide 57. In terms of family interventions, I'm going to spend the last 2 minutes on those three things, then we'll have 7 minutes for questions. The hierarchy of family involvement, the basics is just getting psychoeducation for families, the learning some basics about the disorder. Those of you who are on the call tonight, good. You learned more than you knew before you started it, I hope. Continue to go to all the calls. Reviewing these family guidelines that we publish and I reference, they're available for free on the NEABPD website. I think it's the best brochure I've seen published on this. Just the basic, here's what families with a borderline offspring should know. Support groups can be helpful. Certainly the Family Connections course that I've taught before and many of the people on the call have been involved with is a terrific course. Conjoint sessions where the individual therapist may bring in the patient and the parents together to talk about that can be very helpful. And then finally, family therapy, but that's often not what we recommend early on. All the families want everybody to get in therapy. But what is often the case is initially things are so hot and there is so much mutual blame that until the patient and the parents get to a place where they can diminish the blame, there's really not a lot of utility in putting everybody in the room so they can blame each other. They are already doing that at home. It just doesn't help. Getting the parents to learn some skills to decrease their own reactivity, their own tendency to blame, getting the kid involved in some treatment to help them make more sense of their experience, not need to blame others, taking more interest in their own experience. That's where the action is, and that only until those things are safely in place would we consider family therapy. And then the last two slides summarize these family guidelines, and those are available on the NEABPD website on the family tab right at the top there. It's a terrific brochure that's available to anybody on the call. So with that, we have a few minutes for questions. Jim.
Wow, thank you. The first question is people want to know where they can get training in general psychiatric management and if there's a course available on the web.
There is no web-based course yet. It's a terrific idea. I'll bring it up with John Gunderson. The in-person trainings, there was just one, a couple here, and there was just one in Amsterdam, and I think the next one may be at the APA meeting, American Psychiatric Association meeting, this spring. So we are beginning to do more and more of these. They will be in Chicago next fall. Perry was kind enough to post the most recent trainings on the NEABPD website, so I would continue to look there, and we'll try to make people available as those become available.
Okay, thank you. And this came up last week with Jenny McSeese work with about the children of borderline mothers, but it's come up again, and I think it's a relevant question. For those with borderline who have children, are you aware of any course or any any organized help for the children to understand their parents' borderline behavior?
I have had, and I'd be interested actually in what Dr. McPhee had to say about it as more of an expert on this, but having run family connections groups that had kids in it and having run multiple family groups at McLean that had kids of borderline parents in it, those resources I thought were just terrific in learning to manage your own reactivity, deal with the intermittence of the parents' emotional availability, reactivity, et cetera. The skills that are taught in there, I think, are really, I just think they're terrific. And then the more psychoeducation, the better. I think even the basics of what we talked about tonight, of thinking about the interpersonal context, the important part for kids listening to this talk about their parents or parents listening to this talk about their kids, it's not that we need to protect them from that context. Just because someone feels frightened and anxious and agitated when they're afraid someone is going to leave them, that doesn't mean that we need to protect them from it. It means we need to help them understand how they're managing that. Easier for parents to help their kids, although, as you guys have all learned on the call, not that helpful to try to be your own child or parent's therapist. It just works better to leave it to the professionals. But if you can see it for yourself, it really can help you keep your head on straight in the face of what they're going through. So the more you learn, the more you learn, and these trainings that you're doing tonight and other ones are just terrific.
What about in the case of a grown young adult borderline who hates her therapist? The therapist nevertheless is willing to continue to try to work with the young woman, knows DBT and knows borderline, but you have this intense hatred. Is it worth trying to continue with that, or do you think it's just...
Is the person still showing up week after week?
Apparently.
Are they able to talk about the hatred?
I don't know.
If so, good. I mean, if you can, if my patient will come week after week and say, hey, you just let me down, I'm so upset with you, this is terrible, blah, 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 and the therapist can tolerate it and even acknowledge whatever in there is true, that can be very, very important for the patient. This is expressing negative emotion directly and having somebody be able to tolerate it is wonderful. It's a gift. For family members, when your borderline patient, your borderline offspring is busy yelling at you, and you can say, you know what, there's truth to that. I did turn away from you when you were talking, and I can see how it, I was thinking about dinner, and I just needed to go check the sauce, but I did turn away from you, and I can see how that felt really rejecting and sorry. You know, when you can acknowledge the legitimacy behind somebody's anger, it's a wonderful thing. It helps somebody recognize, oh, my God, I have a right to feel this way. My feelings make sense. There's a way we can talk about this in a relationship. That's good stuff, not bad stuff. So if the therapy is holding together and the therapist is currently in the punching bag position, it's not necessarily a bad sign. So I'd have to know more about the case, but in general, not entirely bad news.
Something to work with.
Something to work with.
There's more questions, so we're going to have to pass some of these on to you, but maybe a quick one here. Is Lexapro okay to take with the borderline diagnosis? Lexapro.
Yep. Lexapro, escitalopram, is a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, SSRI, like Prozac, Paxil, that whole group of medicines. They're all reasonably safe, which is very good news, and the evidence is that it can help some. It does no harm and can help some. So I'd have to know the specifics to comment or anything like that, but in general, it's within the APA treatment guidelines and could be considered. So you know, all of the medicines for borderline, none of them have an FDA indication for borderline.
Right.
The manufacturers aren't going to study these medicines in people who frequently harm themselves or get suicidal. The manufacturers just won't fund these studies. But the treatment guidelines within the standards of care, that would be a reasonable consideration.
I thought you had an excellent part on the pharmacology of involving the patient to help to assess to the extent, if any, that a particular medication was helping and how, and also not to be pouring medications on, but to proceed very cautiously.
It comes from well-meaning psychiatrists and family docs having a poor understanding of the disorder. I treat patients with psychosis or depression, and I want to adjust the molecules, and I want to do that for them and help them. With borderline, helping the patient identify what their experience is the most important part, and we can do a lot of harm as medication providers when we skip that step. And I think that's if we can get that message out to psychiatrists, we could avoid some of the polypharmacy here and be on one medicine at a time, or perhaps two, but principle one medicine at a time, and help the patient get interested in, is this helping? How do I know if it's helping? Yeah, I agree. I think that's important. And again, consistent with the rest of these principles that we're trying to talk about here. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for a super session. I think there's a couple more questions we will have to send to you.
Okay.
And I just want to tell people a story about a psychiatrist doing his residency who encountered a borderline patient, was unsure what to do, looked around on the internet, discovered the NEABPD webpage, and spent the weekend going through the videos and audio recordings there. Got a first-rate education, was so appreciative, and now with this sort of material would even be up that much more. And that resource that's so important is really supported in good part by donations that people make financial. So I encourage people to consider that. And finally, just want to quickly mention we're already starting on the winter-spring call-in sessions. And just to mention three of them, Kim Grant did some early work at McLean on a group treatment for borderline patients with suicidal behavior and got encouraging results, has followed that up, got an NIMH grant for a much larger and rigorous randomized clinical trial evaluation, and those results are very positive, and in March she will be presenting on that work. Brad Reek from psychiatrist at McLean, who is the second person funded by the Borderline Families for More Research through the Brain and Behavior Research Foundation with the NARSED Junior Research Grant, will be presenting on discriminating between borderline and bipolar with a particular focus on symptoms and the neurobiology. And Michael McCluskey, who's now at Temple, was previously at Chicago, was successful in getting two very large R01s. These are the big NIMH grants for randomized clinical trials, one on suicide and SSRIs that's underway, and the other one on treating affective, that is, emotional-based aggression. Very relevant. So just to give you a taste of what's coming up in the winter and spring. And thank you all for calling in, and thank you so much, Dr. Palmer, for just a super session. Everybody have a good evening and a great week, and see you next Sunday for our Connecting with the Dots session.
Thank you, Brian, and thank you, Jim, as well. This was a great call-in. Thank you.